And I'll be the session chair for this particular panel. So I think without waiting for other people, we should begin. You know, one thing, we got to be careful what we wish for, because if we get it, and some other things might happen. And that's what's happening for renewables. In most of the western states, California included, I think it looks like we are on a track to get the level of renewable generation which we thought we would, at large scale as well as distribution level. And of course, that has challenges. So today's session basically deals with distribution level, transmission level, and weather-related challenges, how to mitigate them, how to model them, and possibly provide a solution. So let me start with our first speaker. Our first speaker is from Belgium, and he'll be talking about the problems, how to mitigate the low voltage PV-related distribution problems. So here's Frederik Geth from Belgium.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. So my name is Frederik Geth. I am a PhD student at Belgian University KU Leuven. And as part of my PhD, I work on smart grids demonstration, smart grids research project. And we also have a demonstration phases in the project. We will have a field test with a few hundred households, in which we will install some demand side management technology using a multi-agent system called Intelligator, being developed by one of the partners in the project, Vito, a regional lab. In this project, we also have a number of utilities. We have the regulator. We have some companies providing household devices, which then can be controlled through the demand side management system. The focus of this project is on the low voltage distribution grid down to the device level in the household. So for this project, I work on a work package concerning small scale energy storage. So we decided to develop a battery energy storage system, which we will use in the lab for research and development, and then also later in the field test we will have a demonstration using this same platform. We use lithium iron phosphate batteries, which are reasonably safe. They are equipped with a voltage and temperature measurement system on cell level. We use a converter supplied by a spin-off of my group called Triphase. It's a power electronic platform for rapid prototyping of control strategies. This inverter contains a single-phase grid coupling, a single-phase inverter for grid coupling, and a DC-DC converter for the batteries. This is actually just a normal motor inverter which they stripped off all the electronics and just retained the IGBT half bridges. Then they supply their own control platform again. The filters in this platform are equipped with LCL filters, but actually they can function both in voltage source inversion and current source inversion mode, because the grid side inductance can be bypassed. And a lot of measurements are available in the inverter and the filters. So we decided to make two identical units because the ratings of the platform are given in amps. Actually, we are limited to a variable power. So our maximum charging and discharging power is somewhere between 1.65 kilowatts and 2 kilowatts, volt ampere, depending on the state of charge of the batteries and the voltage in the grid. Each unit is equipped with a 4.3 kilowatt hour lithium iron phosphate battery, which are actually two modules in series with active balancing. The way this inverter is developed allows us to connect two units together through the DC bus and synchronize the switching of the components so they can behave as one single inverter. Then you can make up to a 4 kilowatt single phase grid connection without any modification to the platform. You can also modify the platform internally, and then you can even configure it as a three-phase inverter. You also, because this the control schemes are, you develop yourself, because of the control schemes you develop yourself, you could also put, of course, PV panels on the DC bus. So this is how the platform works. We have the power electronic converter. I will show pictures later how it looks in real life, but the structural topology is that we have a power electronic converter connected to the battery cabinet. In the battery cabinet are the batteries and the target BC. The target BC is a computer that actually runs the control schemes we develop. They are the communication runs in real time from this PC to the FPGA in the power electronic converter. The FPGA in the power electronic converter has no intelligence in itself, except for to avoid overvoltage or overcurrent. So we actually develop control schemes on the engineering PC that also communicates with the cabinets through Ethernet, and there's only one point of coupling to the grid, which makes it easy to install it. So this is how it looks like. On top is the three-phase inverter. Downstairs are the batteries, and in the mid-level is the safety circuitry and the target computer. Again, more in detail, but I think I explained most of it. So this is the control scheme layout. We have the DC-DC converter that's actually controlling the active power, and the inverter allows for controlling the reactive power and keeps the DC bus voltage at 400 volts. This is how it looks like in the Simulink environment where we develop the control schemes. We run the control scheme in real time, and we actually can get the measurements from the inverter back to Simulink during running, which is very easy to develop in. Here are some measurements from a certain charge and discharge set point, so this is actually working very well. So now how do you go to supplying services with such a platform? We have to find an intelligent approach to get the set points for the active and reactive power of this system. For the determination of these set points, we have to have a model of the system and a certain objective function. These objective functions are, of course, then the services we want to provide. For example, target just an economical strategy of arbitrage if you have a time varying market electricity pricing, then you can buy your electricity when it's cheap and sell it again and put it back on the grid when it's expensive, or use it when it's expensive. You could also provide a technical grid service, for example, peak shaving. So that is optimal in your model. You have to take the technical constraints and the economic costs into account. All right. These are some examples of technical energy services we were targeting. Peak shaving can be provided instantaneously by actually compensating the current, but you could also provide it, for example, on an economical basis, depending on the resolution of your electricity cost profile. So then actually just make sure you use this many kilowatt hours in that 15 minutes period. You can provide voltage support in a distribution grid to both active and reactive power, and maybe preferably a mix of them. You can provide frequency support You can provide balancing if your inverter topology allows it. Power quality support, even islanding, because you have batteries. You can also develop more complex support schemes, for example, through the simulation of the behavior of a synchronous machine in your inverter. All right. So the goal is we want to provide as many services as we can because the value of these services depends on the time of day. For example, when it is there is a lot of sun, your PV will generate a lot of energy, but maybe then your voltage would increase above the limit of the norm, and then it makes sense to store this energy instead of let your PV disconnect from the grid. Always have to take into account in your model that battery energy storage system costs money both when you use it, because then your battery degrades through cycling, but also when you not use it, because there's actually a shelf life of the batteries. You also have to know that not only you can also use such a system without using the batteries, because the grid coupling itself provides already some opportunities, for example, to inject reactive power or to filter harmonics. This is a formulation of this is a formulation, a linear programming formulation to optimize for the optimization of the arbitrage strategy. We take the efficiencies of the system into account and the limits of the battery state of charge and limits of connection power, as well as the economic cost of depreciation defined by both shelf life and cycle life. So this is what we come to then. In the middle, you see the parameters we used to compare between to make a theoretical comparison between lead-acid batteries and lithium-ion batteries. They have different capacity, but they have a grid connection of each 3 kilowatt. So on the top left, you see the charge and discharge scheduling for both technologies to provide an arbitrage strategy. On the lower left, the highest graph, you actually see then the grid impact for this arbitrage strategy. On the lowest one of the low left graphs, you see then, sorry, in the middle one of the low left graphs, you see then the optimal peak shaving provided by this lead acid setup. And then the lowest one, you see a set point between them, actually. So then you do a little bit of arbitrage, but you do also a little bit of peak shaving. And then on the lower right, you see the trade-off curve for both these technologies. So in point D, you provide the arbitrage strategy, and then your peak shaving index is very, very high. Here in the point E, you do maximum peak shaving, but then your cost of this, using the system is very high. And in the middle, you have some trade-off strategy which you can actually follow. So in practice, you can always devise some trade-off strategy between a number of objectives. This is again more in detail. So we are trying to translate this to an online control system, but then we have to make some predictions on the load behavior, because of course our battery capacity is very limited and we want to make full use of our available capacity, but if your batteries are empty, then you can't discharge anymore, so you can't, for example, increase the voltage to active power. So you want to make some predictions to run your optimized scheduling. Then you choose your service you want to provide as a function of time, and you run this all over again for example, every 15 minutes. Thank you for your attention. This was my presentation.
From distribution, now we go to transmission, especially dealing with the transmission congestion issues, which are, of course, very real. Some places, such as California, where a lot more large-scale renewable is existing, but we are constrained by transmission. So the next speaker is John. He'll be talking about from C&D Technologies, and he'll be talking about his battery and its application for transmission congestion. John.
Good afternoon. As the slide shows, my presentation is entitled Enabling Renewable Energy Transmission. It's going to deal with advanced liquid carbon energy storage system for transmission utilization improvement. I'll give a brief introduction on C&D, and talk about some of the changing markets that are driving our development at C&D. One of the enabling battery technologies that we're working on, principally advanced liquid carbon storage, and then a case study or a model study enabling renewable energy transmission using energy storage. C&D Technologies, we're over 100 years old. We were founded in 1906. We have battery manufacturing facilities worldwide in U.S., Mexico, and China, distribution centers around the world, and we're headquartered in Bluebell, Pennsylvania. One of our primary markets is energy and infrastructure, where we supply batteries for power generation, transmission, distribution, and switching. We do some grid-scale energy storage, the oil and gas markets, and our product lines include flooded batteries, valve-regulated batteries, and we also do chargers, racks, and electronic monitoring equipment. And our utilities include a number of utility companies, nuclear power plants, and offshore oil platforms. If we look at the traditional stationary battery applications, they were primarily what we would consider float service applications, continual charge, standby power. For the telecommunications, UPS, and energy and infrastructure markets with varying typical runtime capacities. And the only primary cycle service application that we had traditionally was in the energy and infrastructure markets, typically in the oil and gas industry, in conjunction with some type of renewable generation. If we look at those market trends today, while all of our markets are increasing in terms of scope of application, the main shift we're seeing is from float service applications to cycle service, and this is driven primarily by the telecommunications and energy and infrastructure markets. On the telecommunications side, this is driven primarily by the increase of systems in emerging markets, typically what we call hybrid systems, some type of renewable generation, a diesel generator, and a battery, and either grid-connected or off-grid systems. In those systems, the battery is basically providing both standby power as well as optimizing the system efficiency to reduce diesel fuel usage. And in the energy and infrastructure market, we're seeing the basically increase in use of battery storage with renewables, and then in the case of the grid-scale storage systems. And it's really in this overlap between the telecommunications and energy and infrastructure markets that we're focusing our development activities. So if we look at a typical VRLA cycle performance graph, VRLA cycle performance is well documented. The failure modes are well understood. Typically, we see differing failure modes depending on depth of discharge. At high DOD, we have what we call cycle failure. This is essentially failure of the positive active material due to loss of cohesion between the particles. And it's really influenced by the depth of discharge on the cycle. At low depth of discharge, we typically see float or overcharge failure. This is primarily due to the number of repeated charge cycles on the battery. And typically, the cycle service is less affected by depth of discharge than it is by number of repeat charges. And then between, we have what we call transition, and this can be either a function of positive active material failure or, in the case of overcharge failure, positive grid corrosion. And this occurs somewhere between the 30 and 50% depth of discharge range, which is also primarily the area where most of the batteries operate. Now, it should be noted that all of these VRLA cycle performance failures are typically in what we call 100% state of charge operation, which is primarily the battery being fully charged and then discharged repeatedly, and it doesn't account for partial state of charge operation. And partial state of charge operation is primarily where these emerging applications are performing. If we look at peak shifting, stabilization of renewables, or operation with generation, the battery needs to accept opportunity charging, either low cost or available power. And basically, we want to maximize charge efficiency, which again requires partial state of charge operation. And this can be seen in both the applications of load following, where the battery being able to provide energy or load on demand can give twice the stabilization as generation, and in contingency mitigation, which I'll discuss later, where the battery needs to provide load on demand, as illustrated by the figure below. So traditional VRLA technology doesn't really address partial state of charge operation, or it addresses it very poorly. So one of the developments that a lot of people in the industry have been working on is the way to stabilize traditional lead-acid technology or valve-regulated technology for this operation. And one of those enabling technologies is lead carbon. We have what we call advanced lead carbon. This is basically using a unique positive electrode designed for cycling and a lead carbon negative electrode to address the partial state of charge operation. Now, in our solution, we're using an integrated lead carbon negative electrode. We're using integrated carbon in the electrode. And we've really designed the positive electrode for a 50% depth of discharge optimization, which is primarily where the partial state of charge applications run. And just an illustration of the schematic of how that cell works. So carbon in the negative electrode. There are a lot of different types of carbon materials available. They all have a number of different physical and electrical properties. Three types that I've illustrated here are the activated carbons, graphites, carbon black, and they all have slightly different effects on the negative electrode. There's a number of different mechanisms being proposed for how the carbon is affecting the electrode. Obviously, with carbon in the negative at a high enough loading, you significantly increase the electrical conductivity. This is believed to help improve charge characteristics, particularly in partial state of charge, where your reaction product, lead sulfate, is electrically insulating, and the integration of carbon around the sulfate crystals can improve charge acceptance and recharge ability. It's also believed to restrict crystal growth of lead sulfate crystals, primarily restricting the recrystallization of the sulfate crystals, maintaining a small surface or a high surface area, small particle size to allow rechargeability. There's also a question of whether it suppresses hydrogen evolution and whether that's a function of the carbon itself or impurities in the carbon. And finally, it gives some capacitance benefit. This is probably less important in some of our applications, and that's primarily being looked at as a benefit in some of the stop-start mild hybrid applications for these types of batteries. But if we look at the physical changes in the electrode based on carbon, this graph illustrates using various carbons of different surface areas, and it's measuring the carbon BET surface area compared to the negative electrode active material surface area. And we can see that at similar loadings with various surface area materials, we can increase the negative electrode surface area from roughly half a meter squared per gram up to, in this case, approximately 6 meters squared per gram. And we've seen instances where we can increase the negative electrode up to 10 meters squared per gram. And this change in the physical properties of the electrode significantly changes the charge characteristics of the electrode as well. So if we look at a standard TAFL plot, log I versus voltage, of some lead carbon cells utilizing the plates examined in the previous slide, we can see that we are significantly shifting the positive polarization of the electrodes with all carbon additions, but seriously changing the negative polarization as well, from the standard control cells to the lower surface area materials and then up to the high surface area materials. And this change in polarization has a number of benefits, particularly in cycle applications. First of all, it improves charge efficiency in partial state of charge operation. It also has the effect of allowing for equalization on each charge. And this really reduces variation from cell to cell on charge, as well as from battery to battery. And this is typical behavior that we used to introduce into motive power applications for precisely that reason, so that instead of using periodic equalization charges, we could guarantee the recharge of both electrodes on each discharge cycle, discharge-recharge cycle. And this graph just illustrates the partial state of charge operation that we're working in, and just shows the charge efficiency. Basically, we're doing repeated charge-discharge cycles, 30 to 80% DOD, that's a C over 3 rate. These are equivalent charge-discharge cycles using equal amp hours in and out, and then verifying the capacity after each 100 cycle segment, both the 80% state of charge capacity, which is where the battery will operate continually, and then verifying that the full charge capacity is remaining the same over each 100 cycle increment. And over this, we can see that for this 100 cycle segment, we've lost essentially zero capacity in both the partial state of charge cycle. Partial state of charge cycle segments, as well as with full recovery of the capacity on recharge. And the overall round trip efficiency for each cycle, although amp hour efficiency is one, because of the difference in polarization, we see about a 90% round trip efficiency per cycle. And that's sufficient to recharge the cells. And this graph just illustrates how each component actually improves the performance of the cell. If we look at a standard negative electrode in this partial state of charge cycle environment, typical cycle life is around 180 cycles. Primary failure mode on this is sulfation of the negative electrode. Typically, it's unrecoverable. Then using the high carbon negative plates without adjusting the positive electrodes, we get to about 600 cycles, at which point we start to see positive electrode failure, primarily due to loss of cohesion of the active material, and then utilizing both of the stabilized and improved electrodes, getting back up to the typical 1,800 cycles, which is fairly close to what we see in a standard cycle regime for a valve-regulated lead-acid battery not operating in a partial state of charge environment. So by using both electrodes, we see a significant improvement up to 10x in partial state of charge operation compared to a typical standby battery. It essentially is letting the battery charge and discharge at the same rate, which gives us a nice power and energy in the same battery. And the real benefits of this technology is it uses low-cost manufacturing methods and materials, and it uses proven manufacturing processes, and we can utilize this into our existing battery designs, which have, I guess, a 10-year field history. So the next portion is looking at a case study with this technology. It's an example of an application where lead carbon would provide a suit with a utility who was looking to facilitate renewable generation. And one of the primary things that came out of the first discussions, at least in this area, was that renewable energy for this utility is generally their lowest marginal cost energy. And it's really congestion that limits the flow of marginal cost renewable generation. And locating an energy storage system at a congestion point would allow more low-cost renewable generation to flow to load centers in urban areas. And these maps are just depicting the area where the energy storage device would be located and how the generation flows and where the congestion points exist within this area, primarily between the Wisconsin and Illinois state line along Lake Michigan. Some of the benefits of locating an energy storage device at a pinch point: it allows to increase the line rating of a limiting transmission segment. It reduces transmission congestion, and it really improves the flow of low-cost power benefiting consumers. And the increased ability to transport wind and other renewables, and we were also looking at offsetting some of the cost by providing additional benefits that energy storage is capable of. And obviously, the most congested elements have the greatest impact on reducing flows from low marginal cost generation. And the value of the energy storage is really location dependent, where market price is a function of the congestion at the pinch point. So this is a simplified schematic depiction of the application. If you think about a transmission bottleneck, as we depicted it here, it's three lines. Each line would have a rated capacity of 600 megawatts during normal operation and 750 megawatts during a contingency event. This is essentially the line limit that the the limit the line can carry for 30 minutes. So a normal operation without a battery, although the lines can each carry 600 megawatts, they're all limited to 500, because during a contingency event, obviously one line disappears, the remaining two lines have to pick up the entire load, which limits them to the 500 megawatts. However, if you use a battery or an energy storage device along one of the lines, it allows the line's continual transmission capacity to be increased, I'm running out of time here, by amount equivalent to the battery's capacity. Because during a contingent event, obviously one line disappears, the battery is charged with the increased capacity, and the remaining two lines can pick up the other amount. We also realize that being able to provide multiple solutions from a single system can give greater benefit. So when we developed the operation model, we were looking at providing the primary operation being contingency reserve and the secondary operations, because we're only running a 50% state of charge, it could be used for contingent reserve and peak price sales. So then looking at the life estimates and the duty cycle, we provide all three functions. The transmission utilization providing 20 megawatts of power for 30 minutes as required by a contingent model with a few cycles per year, and then the contingent reserve and peak price sales. All of these allowing the system to function for its full calendar life of 10 years. Just a depiction of the units, and I'm over my time, so I'm going to speed through these. And really the benefit, and why we chose lead carbon, I mean, primarily due to cost. The lower cost of the system, the fact that it's in a standby operation mode for most of the application life, really makes it the most effective solution in this application. And a summary of the benefits, it enables transmission utilization that facilitates renewable energy to high-cost load, reduces congestion and improves efficiency, get multiple solutions from a single system, and the benefits extend beyond the operator to the grid. And I have to get to my acknowledgments. I want to thank We Energies for their assistance on the application and their expertise, and Cabot Corporation for their assistance on the materials development work. Thank you.
It's too sad that when it was getting really interesting, we just ran out of time, but I'm sure there'll be time during question and answer session to kind of follow up on what John was discussing. Our next speaker is Ben Norris. Ben has been involved with energy storage for many, many years, one of the early pioneers in energy storage area. His biography, of course, is in the program booklet. And he'll be talking about how to manage the nice fluffy clouds which create problems for us in managing the photovoltaics. So here's Ben Norris.
Of NAS battery in the United States. In this topic, NAS batteries installed in this country will be introduced, especially wind to battery project by Xcel Energy is focused on. The second topic is 80 megawatt NAS battery system being installed in Japan. This picture shows the NAS batteries which have been installed in the United States. Total 11 megawatts of NAS batteries have been installed by American Electric Power. Also, 1 megawatt by New York Power Authority and 1 megawatt by Xcel Energy. Deploying the NAS battery installed by Xcel Energy, a demonstration project, which is called Wind 2 Battery, has been implemented. I'd like to talk about this project. This figure shows the system diagram of Wind 2 Battery project. 1 megawatt NAS battery with PCS is connected to 34.5 kV grid. 7 wind turbines, total 11.5 megawatt, are connected to the same grid. And the grid is connected to the transmission line via interconnect of Midwest Independent Transmission System Operator. In the United States, this is the first application of NAS battery to store the wind energy directly. In the wind to battery project, these demonstrations were implemented. The first one is called basic generation storage. This is also called time shifting or load leveling. The second one is frequency regulation. In this operation, the battery follows a frequency regulation signal, both as a load and a generator. The third one is wind leveling. This operation is also called steady output control or constant power control. The battery is used to reduce the uncertainty of wind power, and it is charged or discharged to limit the deviation between scheduled power and actual power from a wind farm. The other operating modes, those are called wind smoothing or economic dispatch, are also demonstrated. Today, I'd like to focus on two demonstrations, frequency regulation and wind leveling. At first, I'd like to talk about the demonstration of frequency regulation. In this figure, the horizontal axis shows time and the vertical axis shows power. The blue line shows area control error signal from independent system operator. A frequency regulation signal is generated from the AC signal at 4 second intervals. In this case, the dead band range was set plus minus 100 megawatt. When AC signal shows under generation exceeding 100 megawatt, the battery is commanded to discharge. Contrary, when AC signal shows overgeneration exceeding 100 megawatt, the battery is commanded to charge. We can see NAS battery responds promptly, synchronizing with the AC signal. The next operation mode is wind leveling. In this operation mode, the operator specifies the scheduled power output of the wind and the battery combined system every 30 minutes. As the power output from the wind farm deviates from the scheduled value, the battery system is commanded to charge or discharge to compensate for the difference. For this operation, the wind scaling factors were applied to make the wind farm appear as if it were a 1 megawatt, 5 megawatt, and 10 megawatt wind farm. This figure shows the case of 1 megawatt wind and 1 megawatt NAS battery. Green line shows the power from the wind farm. Blue line shows the delivered power to the grid from the system. It means sum of wind power and NAS power. We can see that the NAS power, which is shown in the red line, compensates the wind power and the delivered power is leveled. So these demonstrations by X-ray energy prove the technical capability of NAS battery for various applications. The next topic is large-scale NAS battery to be installed in Japan. 80 megawatt NAS battery is being installed at Noshiro, northern part of Japan, for Tohoku Electric Power Company. The total capacity is 480 megawatt hour, and the purpose of this installation is peak cutting. The standard system size for this installation is 2 megawatt. 10 sets of 2 megawatt systems. It means 20 megawatt will be installed in one building. 4 buildings will be installed at one site. The voltage of the grid to be connected to this battery system is 275 kV. This figure shows the plan view of the system in the building. The layout allocating PCS area between two battery areas achieved shorter cable lengths. The temperature in the building is maintained by ventilation without the use of auxiliary heating cooling equipment. To confirm an adequate design of the battery building and the ventilation system, thermal simulation has been conducted. This figure shows an example of thermal simulation of the battery area. An interior rack system to support the NAS battery module is adapted to shorten the delivery and construction time. This picture shows the same rack system, which has been applied for 4 megawatt NAS battery at Presidio, Texas. Short real time offered by this approach were verified through the project. Now, let me summarize what we discussed. In the United States, total 13 megawatts of NAS batteries have been installed. The demonstration by Xcel Energy proved technical capability of NAS battery for various applications, such as wind leveling and frequency regulation. In Japan, the installation of 80 megawatt NAS battery is ongoing. That concludes what I described in my abstract, but there is one additional issue I'd like to speak about today. It is about an accident related to NAS battery, which occurred in the last month. A fire of as yet unknown origin was reported at a NAS battery installation on September 21st. The 2 megawatt NAS battery installation involved is located in industrial facility at Ibaraki Prefecture, Japan, about 30 miles northeast of Tokyo. Although no personal injuries or collateral damage were involved, battery active materials were ignited during the event, an outcome that was not expected and that NGK regards as very serious. Pending the result of further investigations, all NAS batteries customers have been advised to place their installations in a cold shutdown state. Continued operation of NAS installation in critical applications may be permissible, with enhanced monitoring and being considered on a case-by-case basis. NGK is investigating the fire in cooperation with local authorities. The cause is not evident from data collected prior to the event, and on-site examinations have not yet been permitted. From the information available, it appears that active materials ignited in up to 10 of the 40 modules in the 2 megawatt installation. NGK's detailed investigation will start as soon as possible, with the goal of completing it by the end of this year. NGK is actually aware of the need to ensure the safety of our energy storage products. We intended to learn from this experience and to implement measures that will restore operational and investment confidence in NAS battery installations. We know that safety is top priority. Thank you for listening. The 80 megawatt NAS battery will be owned by electric power company called Tohoku Electric Power Company. The purpose of the battery will be used to pick cut because the power generator in Tohoku area was damaged by the earthquake which occurred on March. So the power company is making every effort to gather the generation facilities. So our battery is one of the facility to add the capacity of generation. And the cost of it is not, I'm not sure how much is it, sorry.
Anthony has a question here.
Anthony Price, question for Ben. Ben, thank you very much for your insight into the variability. When we've looked at variability issues and diversification of renewable resources in Great Britain, and the rules about averaging are used as a way of mitigating the effect of renewables on the grid, at first sight it appears to be good news that you don't need much to mitigate it because on averaging everything's going to be okay. But when you look at putting all the worst cases together, which frequently happen, or when things go wrong, it's because all the worst cases happen at the same time. The implications are severe. Have you considered the effect of variability when you've got both clouds happening at the wrong time and demand happening at the wrong time and other variables happening at the wrong time as well?
Yeah, so if it wasn't clear, that chart where we actually went through that sort of simple calculation of variability for those 5,400 megawatts, those were the worst cases in every single case. In other words, we took that same data that we took in Napa for a single point and applied that same variability for all however many plants there were, 600 some odd plants, okay? However, again, we assumed that the variability had that dispersion effect. We took into account the distance between them. In other words, the simplifying assumption was only that each plant was completely uncorrelated, but each plant did have exactly that same variability.
I'd like to ask a variation on that question. What happens when you have a major storm come through and they all go out at once? What does that leave you with? We certainly see that in Colorado, where we'll have a storm and it's cloudy all day.
Yeah, so first of all, if you have a storm and all the PV plants go out, the total output is zero. This data that we took was under, needless to say, storm condition. In fact, the worst case for variability is not actually heavy rains, because clearly you have very little PV output over the course of the day when you have a heavy overcast. But that's not the highest variability. You're going to have to deal with the generation issues. This is not addressing, you know, day-to-day variability. This is addressing minute-by-minute variability. So having a lot of clouds does not make it more variable. In fact, it's the real patchy clouds with lots of wind. And you have some magnification effects when you have the sun bouncing off some clouds. And so you have, you know, about a 1.2 multiplier on that.
There's a question in the front here.
Yeah, it's a question for Mr. Anderson or Dr. Anderson. I didn't get your affiliation. Jerry Wolf, Batteries and Energy Storage Technology magazine. I think you did a very good presentation of showing how much further lead acid technology has come on, which maybe many people in the audience weren't aware of. But the overall life of your systems at the end of your presentation still seem to be quite short, 10 years, and that's if used just a few times in that period. You didn't discuss whether those batteries would degrade as a result of getting hot in those storage cabinets, the trailers that you put them in. And I wonder how much of an effect temperature still has on batteries designed as you described.
Well, in the application I described, the batteries that we had proposed for the system are essentially a 10-year calendar life battery. In the application as expected, the average battery temperature should remain around 25 degrees C. I mean, we had designed the containers so that they do have HVAC inside. Obviously, you're still going to see the same degradation with accelerated temperature on all VRLA batteries independent of whether it's a lead carbon battery or a standard VRLA, because the acceleration factor is on the current collector of the positive electrode, and it's not really taking into account acceleration on the negative electrode. So in a telecom system where we see typical application or cycle requirements, those batteries, depending on how hot the system run, can be anywhere from a year to 4 years, because they typically sacrifice the batteries for everything else. It's just the way they run those systems. So. Does that answer the question? Okay.
And there's a question in the back, and then there's a question here after that. There's a question in the back.
This is a question for Ben, Peter Coppin, CSIRO Australia. I'd like to take you back to the first part of your presentation where you were looking at the worst-case day and trying to turn that into a storage argument, the diversification argument. What you were referring to was, in when you said the size of the storage, you actually, I think, meant the throughput of the power system. If you're trying to turn that into storage, the storage requirement is the integral under the variable bit of the curve. Have you looked at how that parameter would vary with diversification? Because, you know, you're integrating under a lot of very rapid spikes, which may not have a lot of energy content. And I'd be very interested to see the way that number diversifies, if you like.
Yeah, I that is not something we've looked at, and that would be an obvious next question as far as storage. You're absolutely right. We when you calculate, say, for example, that 15 megawatt example, that is the power throughput, and so it would have to be able to charge and discharge 15 megawatts. And actually, that would be sort of a statistically, you'd want to double that, to have or triple that even for your 95% confidence level. But no, we did not look at over time. I mean, over time, that averages out to zero, right, the charge and discharge. But we did not get into those specifics, and that's subject for additional research then.
Vincent, you have a question there.
This question is for Hata-san. At 70% depth of discharge for your batteries, what is the expected cycle life?
Sorry, would you say one again?
At a deep discharge, 70%, what is the expected cycle life, end of life, for your battery? How many cycles or how many years?
I need to calculate to answer, but if you free charge, our battery can cycle 4,500 cycles, and if 70% discharge, it will be more than that.
It'll be more than that at 70%.
Yes. Mm. More than 4,500 cycles. Okay.
Thank you.
There's a question in the back, and then you, sir.
Dirk Schneider, SKL Group. I have also a question for Hata-san. There was 80 megawatts in Japan, but there's also the Rubinos project in Mexico with 1 gigawatt. I wonder if there's any news on that topic.
Hata-san,
For now, I have no hard information about it, so I can't reply your question now.
I think there's a question up in the front. Yes, sir.
Walt James from Optimal Power Solutions. A question for John Anderson. Compared to a lead acid battery, what's the maximum charge rate that you can get now with this lead carbon?
In some of the applications, we're usually, if I relate everything to a 1C rate of the battery capacity, which is typically not the nameplate rating you'll see on the label, in some of the telecommunication systems, they're charging up to 4 and 5C, simply because they're in areas where the grid stability is so questionable that they're just guaranteeing recharge as fast as possible. Now, those are some of the applications where they destroy the batteries very quickly. But again, they're looking for, you know, maximum efficiency on the diesel genset versus preserving the battery life.
So is it 4C that you're talking about?
What's yeah, four or 5C. Usually 4 or 5X the typical battery capacity or the site load.
I think there's time for one more question.
John, just to follow up, what would be the premium for the advanced lead acid as it compared to VRLAs cost-wise that we would be expecting?
Typically, it's probably a 10% adder if I compare it to a standard telecommunications VRLA battery. It's probably closer to parity with what we would call a cycling, a deep cycle battery or something of that nature in the valve regulated.
Well, if there are no more questions, are there any more questions? If none, let's give a round of applause to our speakers today. Thank you. Thank you.